There is the foundational freedom. There is the era of justice in community. The era when community really works so that there is the rights of each person, so that each person is worth something, so that the life of the community achieves its full humanity. And now, which is a recapitulation of covenant, fundamentally the era when the covenant really is working. And now, in the second oracle, there's a recapitulation of creation. Once you have gone back to, once you have had the liberation, the covenant, then the creation will go back to paradise. And you have the wonderful, wonderful picture of that ancient, ancient memory that once upon a time, who knows where or when, but just once upon a time, there was a day when the trees and the sky and the animals and the human beings all lived happily in one, well, I suppose the best word for it around here is village, you know, where the universe was a village. And just listen to this. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse. Notice that one of the last judgment oracles talked about the, in Isaiah, the end of Isaiah 6, and though a tenth remain in it, it will be burned again like a terebinth or an oak whose stump remaining standing when it is felled, the holy seed is its stump. So Israel has been burned over and toppled like a stump, and so After that, then, the promise, the metaphor for promise is a shoot. There shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of its roots. And now the description of the king, the qualities of the king. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord. And in this sense, the fear of the Lord in the Old Testament is not panic so much in this case as it is respect, reverence, adoration of the Lord. And his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He'll enjoy the majesty, the integrity, the goodness of God. Quite a set of attributes. If we could find leadership like that, maybe something would happen. And the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. Notice that most of the qualities desired and pictured are qualities of judgment, not qualities of technique. In other words, the leadership needed a certain kind of judgment, not simply a certain kind of education. So the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, counsel and might, Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Lord, and his delight shall be in the fear of the Lord. He'll not be the kind of, the second important thing, there's no peace without justice. There's no order without a judge who can, in other words, there's nothing. However utopian they are in some places, the prophets never imagine that you can have harmony, you can eliminate conflict. What they really imagine is that you have good judges, that you have processes for resolving conflict fairly. They don't have a notion of people as automatically turning out all alike. What they do have a notion of is that there's law, there's one law, and so that there can be leadership which discriminates between parties. Now, instead of being the kind of judge who just pays attention, he will not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear. Instead of being the kind of judge who pays attention to appearances, you know, who gives one answer when the client is wealthy and another answer when the client is poor, who pays attention to all the implications for the judgeship for Israel. He'll not judge by what his eyes see or decide by what his ears hear. In other words, it's not going to be simply political justice that caters to lobby and caters to the self-interests of the clients. But with righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. The real test, it's no test of a judge to acquit the rich. The real test of the king, the real test of the judge, and it remains, you know, it just remains a major test of the integrity of a nation, is how they treat the poor, how they treat the voiceless, the meek, the voiceless people in their society. And you can go right down and tell something about the spirit and meaning of a nation or a people by their handling of the dependent people in the society. And Israel had from the very beginning had a notion that the community was responsible for the dependent ones as well as the productive ones. And so this was the test, and I think it applies, you know, it applies to America, it applies to the Christian church. The measure of the Christopher Stendahl from Harvard had a wonderful sermon once at St. Olaf on Forgiveness Company Incorporated. On the measure of the church is not so much how much it achieves, but how open it is to various kinds of needs. Well, he shall judge by what his eyes see and decide by what his ears hear. With righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips he shall slay the wicked. Righteousness shall be the girdle of his waists, and faithfulness the girdle of his loins. I put it in plain English. His pants will be righteousness and his belt faithfulness. And now the wonderful. When that happens, when there is leadership with judgment, and when the judgment is manifested by the righting of wrongs, by the dealing with the dependent, then the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, the calf and the lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. The cow and the bear shall feed, their young shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. The sucking child shall play over the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the adder's den. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. When justice is done among the nations of the earth, when justice is done within the societies of the earth, then we'll be back in paradise. Then we'll be back in paradise. And the divisiveness, the devouring forces of life will be brought into some kind of harmonious whole. My question for you on this text is, it's simple enough to see that Isaiah was speaking to people who were losing hope about their country, Israel, which was both a nation and the people of God. It's simple enough to see that this meant that they should continue to trust Yahweh and renew their peoplehood, renew their nation. Who do you think it applies to now? And does it apply to America? Does this apply to the church? Is there some sense in which the promise of the Messianic Age is still partly open, or is it all over? Do you see a passage like this as having been done and over in Christ? If Christ is this king, is he really about this? Let me put it this way.
Lord's Prayer, I was just thinking that constant cry unto God from the whole earth is continued cry before him. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth.
As it is in heaven. Not in heaven as it is on earth, or thy kingdom done in heaven because it can't get done on earth. Thy kingdom... But supposing Christ is still in the line of the Davids, supposing Christ is in the line of the Davids, and Christ is God's will for justice, for community, I guess I'm asking if this is, I'm restless with either reading this passage as done and over with when Christ comes, and from here on we think of forgiveness but not of justice. We worry about the inner and not the outer. I'm restless with the, you know, I'm restless with the dichotomy that says this will really never happen. This is on the other side of the mountains of this earth. This is on the other side of the planet. We will attend to the meanings of forgiveness and love and trust and discipleship. And maybe after the world blows up, the Lord will attend to justice. Is there some sense in which, if Christ is the Messiah, or if we really are confident, if we really have been given the faith that he is the Messiah, is there some sense in which this means something for what the church should be about? Now, not...
Well, I think Carol mentioned the Lord's Prayer. When Jesus prays, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth, and he is praying for this, and this is what we are to be praying for, and the will of God is to be done on earth. it seems obvious that what we know of God in the scriptures is the one who is concerned about all men, and therefore, you know, there isn't a, you know, there really can't be a dichotomy. You know, there can't be a separation between, you can't say discipleship and mean just one thing. And then it seems to me that the message is a total. It's baptizing and teaching, and the combination has got to be the whole man that has to be redeemed, so that the whole community, people have to be helped all the way.
Well, would this mean that really a church ought to be concerned on the one hand, about people growing to a mature faith, concerned about the personal appropriation of grace, and on the other hand, ought to really be concerned about the justice of Christ in the both in the community and in the whole nation.
I don't really think it's, I don't like a left hand and a right hand on it because I really believe that if you love God with your whole heart, mind, and soul, I have a really hard time with myself on dealing with this. I mean, I'm trying to enjoy personal meditation without a without reaching out towards people who are in need, and why we have such a feeling of, you know, continuous hypocrisy, and why we need a lot of affirmation on both sides. I think you have to care for the whole community. I don't think the message is a divided one.
I even think you have to specifically set it up so that it will be that way. Like, we go without Tuesday noon meal here all during fall, winter, spring, and that money goes to World Hunger. Only way the kids who don't make any income can give it. We can give it on the part of the village. You've got to do it specifically. All through my younger days, every Saturday night, I tried to get rid of whatever money I still had in this world so Sunday morning I could preach freely with only nothing, you know. And it wasn't hard to do then. But, you know, I mean, pay parsonage, I mean, I burnt down, I'd send some money to the preacher to $15 for his, you know, library or something. So I'd be broke Sunday when I was preaching. And this was easy to do then. I didn't have it done. But just so that feeling that you're completely free, and that you know that you're in the Lord's hands. I think there are times that God tests all the time. He just comes to you. Mary and I just got a buck a day for our stay in prison camp, for instance. One of my members came up, and they, all this a newspaper, not that we're there, but they got this, you know, award. And he was going bankrupt, needed $2,500. Well, that figured out pretty close. And he got it, you know, he needed it more than we did. But you have to continue to be open to that. Larry is the most tricky guy, you know, that way, that's why I can say it precisely. I think you have to be continually open to God at that point. You cannot divide this world. Methodists have done a better job putting together than Lutherans have here, because we've had this right-hand, left-hand angle. Can you know?
When they've had full Methodist piety, they've done a terrific job.
Yeah. No, they did. And we say this at our seminary.
Wesley did a good job of holding the love of God and the love of the poor together. But can you imagine a good Lutheran parish where they'd have worship at 9:30 and at 10:30 they'd have town meeting in which the members of the community, maybe the deacons, would brief the congregation on the concerns, the community concerns, the bills that were before Congress that they ought to write the congressman about, the things that were happening in the town, the sort of the week's agenda. The week's.
Norm Hammer did this now, basically in Watertown. Very interesting.
Did it work?
Well, here's what he did. I mean, he better paid most of the people. I was too. And Eastfold asked me how I could stay spiritual on Saturday. I thought, asked him how he managed. He was making a little more, but he was doing two jobs. I told him, well, after all, I was doing five, according to what he taught us at seminary. But he'd asked me, because Hammer comes in for $7,500, you know, back then, 1954. And, well, I was going to stay spiritual on that money. But one of the first things he did was to have a mass meeting in the auditorium on a low wage scale in the community. The first things Hammer did. And I mean, this is a pietist way of doing it, but it sure creates a public opinion fast, you know. All you have to do is stick your own neck on the block to do it. So I think it's happening lots of times. Now, we had deacon funds always that nobody knew anything about. One guy in the deacons shared with me where that money went. That was all. Because it was the people who would never ask the government. These are things I think congregations continue.
Well, and it seems to me we might very well revive our sense of the diaconate, of electing men and women to a deacon leadership in the parish who would assist with the worship and then be the ones in the parish who would counsel the congregation and facilitate the congregational discussion of the agenda for the week. Let's end up with some things about Isaiah's call in Isaiah 6. All the way through this, I have been emphasizing the concern articulated in the quotation of Martin Buber with the phrase theopolitics, the vision that faith in Yahweh implied thinking theologically, thinking about accountability, thinking about covenant, thinking about future, thinking about the integrity of God, that faith involved thinking and acting. It involved
theopolitics.
It involved thinking about reflection on the character and futures of God, and involved concrete expectations in social reality.
That's a good phrase. That last one should be repeated about 5 times. In concrete expectations
in social reality.
And I say it again.
Concrete expectations in social reality. It involved reflection, and we I think most of us have, and at least in our tradition where we've had a high respect for training of clergy, have had some interest in this, but reflection which ties to and interacts with concrete politics, concrete expectations about how the meanings of covenant are lived out in society and lived out in social interactions. And, you know, this kind of concern is not sustained very easily. Isaiah didn't have such an easy time. Ahaz, well, the first, no, not Ahaz, but the first one he worked, yeah, it was Ahaz, was not so easy to work with. And they didn't listen to him all the time. This holding to this the freedom of God, the openness of God, and his strength in a very real way, rooted in his very simple call and his own basic inner experiences of God. And it's a very simple one, and there are a lot of illusions exploded by Isaiah's call. Where do you think something like this happened? What's the furniture, what's the setting, what's the atmosphere of his call vision? And where does this go on? I saw the Lord sitting upon the throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Where is he? You know, Amos had a very dramatic one out in the desert, one in the roar of the lion. Where's Isaiah?
His train filled the temple.
He's in church. Can you imagine that a call can happen even in church? You don't have to be on the baseball field. You don't have to be struck by lightning. You don't have to be. Have the lions on your back, or have somebody in your family die, or have the country fall over. You know, it might even happen in church. Because this, the throne, you remember that the center of the altar had this thing which sort of represented a throne for God, but God was not sitting there. He was a spirit that dwelled there. So that's temple furniture, and his train filled the temple, seraphim, wings, and two with the 6 wings. And the priests are going by, that holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory. This is the traditional grounding, the sense of the otherness of God, the sense of the majesty and wonder, the sense of praise, and one call to another. And in this whole thing, Isaiah has this overwhelming sense of his own worthlessness in the presence of all this work. And he's cleansed. He has a sense of God enveloping him and cleansing him and restoring him. And then quite contrary, notice something. You know, there's a lot of talk that sometimes you have to wait till the Lord grabs you and says, calls you by name and says, this is the only thing you can do. You can't do anything else, you've got to do this. But now notice this is a much more, the Lord has an open meeting. You know? Amazing. It isn't just a compulsion in this case. What a different kind of call from Hosea. It isn't just a compulsion just laid on somebody so that they can't avoid it. It's after the cleansing part, then there's a question, whom shall I send and who will go? And lo and behold, Isaiah volunteers. You have to be a little mad to volunteer for this kind of a job, but once you've been refreshed and your defenses are softened up, you just might be reckless enough to volunteer for something that you know you can't do. And but notice it isn't this marvelous. You got to pay attention to these call stories because they're all different, and there are even some of the prophets that don't have any call stories at all, so that they just sort of eased into their jobs without anybody knowing anything about it or them having anything that they wanted to talk about, you know. But the Isaiah is the sort of beautiful example of a gracious call story, you know. The temple, the celebration of the holiness and praise of God, the sense of worthlessness and the sense of being cleansed and forgiven and restored and being free. And then the voice, well, God scratching his head, well, I wonder who's going to do that? Who's going to take this nasty job? And then Isaiah, you know, fresh from the bath of forgiveness, well, send me. And it was a nasty message. I mean, if you can figure out what he was supposed to say to the people, let me read the chapter, because it's a troublesome message. It's sort of telling them to... It's telling them partly to explain things to them and partly to keep it all obscure. Okay, we'll finish up, and I'll turn it over to Bill just after we read through this sixth chapter. In the year that King Uzziah died, I had a vision of the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim, each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Then flew one of the seraphim to me, having in his hand a burning coal which he had taken from the tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, Behold, this has touched your lips, your guilt is taken away, and your sin is forgiven. And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, there wasn't much recovery time, Whom shall I send and who will go for us? Then I said, Here am I, send me. And he said, Go and say to this people, Hear and hear, but do not understand. See and see, but do not perceive. Make the heart of this people fat and their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn and be healed. Moses at least had a good job of pulling it together, and David had a job of being successful, and Isaiah had a job of interpreting disaster. And he said, then I said, how long? How long? And he said, then I said, how long? How long? And he said, until cities lie waste without inhabitant, and houses without men, and the land is utterly desolate, the Lord removes men far away, and the forsaken places are many in the midst of the land. And though a tenth remain in it, and it will be burned again like a terebinth or an oak, whose stump remains standing when it is felled, and the holy seed is the stump. Hard, hard oracles to give he had. Good thing he didn't know all the oracles he was going to get when he volunteered. But he did. And his willingness and faithfulness in bearing through those oracles and the critique of his country and the vision of the futures beyond enabled him to be a pointer, a signboard for Yahweh in the midst of a very crucial time in Israel. And I wonder if sometimes, maybe even parts of America can be signboards. And I wonder if in some sense prophecy hasn't been given to the church, so that the community of Yahweh, the community of the Lord Jesus Christ, is called to criticize exploitiveness and pride, called to witness to what the paradise that the world might be and could be, and Wouldn't it be great if the church would volunteer to carry the hard words of the Lord as well as the good words of the Lord?
Thank you very much.